The world around us is built up of infinite diversity and infinite combinations. Artists of all types commonly embody a diverse set of talents and interests. This gives them a rich array of experiences to draw upon in their work. Today's guest surrounds his passion for technology with a diverse collection of experiences, which provides him a strong foundation for solving many of the hard problems faced by modern operating systems. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Richard Ward, distinguished engineer in the Windows Core Architecture Group. I hope you enjoy this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code. Richard comes from a family with a strong passion for technology. But despite that, or perhaps in support of it, his own path to Microsoft was one which included a variety of personal interests and studies. Attending a liberal arts college and often spending a lot of time with studio arts and theatrical engineering, Richard's path finally brought him to Microsoft in 1989, where he has become a leader in the very infrastructure of Windows. But before we bring Richard out, let's hear from one of his colleagues, Rebecca Norlander.
When I heard that Richard was being asked to participate in Behind the Code, I was very excited. Richard has a long history at the company, and he's been a great asset to Microsoft and to the industry. But really what I wanted to do was figure out what I could say on camera that was, you know, dirt or secretive or something that would get people to really laugh or know who Richard is. So I thought about it for a long time, and I racked my brain, and I contacted all of our friends, and we all sent mail back and forth. But at the end of the day, Richard Ward is a quiet force who has greatly impacted both Microsoft Windows and the industry at large in, you know, Windows and security technologies. And there's not a lot of bad things that you can say about him.
Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Richard Ward. So, no dirt, huh?
Great. Best way to start, I think.
You know, that was Rebecca's chance to actually get back at you for you not be able to say anything bad about her. No.
Well, yeah, except as an office mate, that was good.
Yeah. So, I mean, technology. How did you first get started in technology? What piqued your interest from a childhood standpoint?
It was something kind of ever-present in our house. My parents actually met at IBM, and my mom was actually the software engineer, so we were kind of...
And what did your dad do?
He was in sales, actually. selling to the banks on Wall Street. But he was always interested in engineering, and my mom had a software background, and you know, the notion of computers was not foreign to our house really ever.
So there really wasn't any time where you said, gee, what is this technology thing? It just was always there, just like food and TV and grass. Yes.
Technology was much larger back then. It wasn't quite like we have now where there are gadgets everywhere.
So how do you think then your growing up was different than other children who probably weren't so imbued with technology?
I don't think it was terribly different at all. You know, we still played outside, rode our bikes and all those good things, but we also learned different base arithmetic and things like that at home.
Different base arithmetic.
Yeah, you know, we had to learn hex and binary and octal when we were growing up.
That's a little bit different. Did you realize why you were needing to learn that?
Not really.
Or were your parents just having fun with you?
I think my dad was just having fun with us for that one.
And what did your teachers think of that?
Well, it didn't really apply until many years later. So, you know, when you encounter this stuff in normal math courses, I remember this. We did this around the kitchen table. It does make you think oddly a little bit, but yeah.
So, what was your first computer?
The first computer we had was that we all had to use, got a chance to use, was the Commodore PET. My dad came home with it in 1978.
Yeah, I remember those computers, kind of those strange little devices with a little built-in monitor on the top of it and everything.
It was all in one. It was large and heavy. It was the bigger one. It was 8K.
Mm-hmm. Heck, my watch has more memory than that now.
Yeah.
So, what was your first program you remember writing? And what language was it in?
Well, the language was BASIC, of course. Everything ran on BASIC. And I don't know if you... Those days, You could get these books worth of games and odd programs and big source books that you would then type everything all in, because there was no common interchange format at that point. Mm-hmm. The Commodore had a tape drive that used, a cassette tape drive that used one format, and no one else had the same thing. So you would type it all in all over again, do the little moon lander simulation or something like that.
Remember one of my first computers, I spent all day long typing in the program and then realized I didn't have the tape interface program for it, so I couldn't even save it. So I just had to turn the computer off at the end of the day, and all that stuff was gone. So from there, where did you take and move from a computer science or technology standpoint from the early PETs and things like that?
We had, starting from that point, we had a computer in the house all the time, and we had a... There was a joint project between TRW and Fujitsu that my father was involved in, so he had something from that era. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Albany, New York, and then he was working at a different bank, and that was a total IBM shop, so we got a PC.
Mm-hmm. And each of the kids have their own computer?
Oh, no. not quite there yet. There was one computer. And
you had to fight for it.
My siblings are substantially older than I was, so by the time we got
to... So you didn't get much time on the computer then?
Well, they were onto other things as teenagers that they were... And when I was 12 and 13, I was like, ooh, look at this. It's all to myself. So.
Now, your siblings, did they also go into the technology area?
To some degree. My brother tends more towards hardware. Mm-hmm. And my sister, I guess, tends more towards design rather than hardware or software. Mm-hmm.
And when did you know that you wanted to go into technology as a career?
That's kind of a tough question. There's lots of different ways you go with technology, and for a while I was thinking, well, wouldn't pure science research be fascinating? You read all about astronomy and physics, and wow, cool stuff going on there. But I think once I had a chance to start creating real programs and real things on the computer, then that got me hooked.
The bug got you then with that?
It's a great creative output where you can do something and type it up and you can see results. It's actually pretty cool.
From an educational standpoint, after high school, where'd you focus on going to get your computer science degree?
Opted for a liberal arts college, small liberal arts college nestled in the heart of the Berkshires.
A liberal arts college?
Yep.
And what drew you to that college specifically?
That specifically was a great college. doing the little college tour and your senior year of high school, and then you settle on whatever you want. But computer science course was, as majors, were just kind of kicking off in the liberal arts world at that point. So most of them were still offshoots of the math department, and they were just coming into their own as a new discipline.
For nowadays, almost every school has a big, gigantic computer science program going on in it.
I think many schools do have these programs. I don't know if they're big, gigantic. Depends on the school.
So being at a liberal arts school, did you actually then take and study some of the liberal arts courses in addition to the technology?
Definitely. I think part of the goal behind, I guess, liberal arts in general is to have a rounded liberal education, right? Well, not liberal politically, but liberal in coverage. So,
what sort of courses?
That was 20 years ago.
Who were your teachers?
Covered languages and art and economics and.
I understand you did some theater work there too, though.
I did help with the theater group on campus, and I continued helping with a French theater down in Seattle when I came out here for a while.
So in the theater stuff you did there at the college, what sort of, were you like an actor on stage?
Or? No. I'm not one to trod the boards. I did the lights and the technical aspect of theater.
So lights, yeah, okay.
Lighting design, some sound work.
So you're one of the people that we're always waiting on to get the lights finally fixed up before we can actually start the show, right?
Because it's very hard as a technical person to wait for all this talent to like stop vibrating and getting everything focused. And they never get their cues right.
And you're saying you actually continue on in the theater from that standpoint. So you've been in theater since then till now, or take a break or something?
So I guess, 2 or 3 years after I came out here, some friends of mine from college moved out to Seattle and set up a Fringe Theater, Theater Schmieder down in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And so I helped out there on their board. I did several shows, and yeah, it's a charitable organization. Everyone can donate. It's great.
We'll be passing out cards later.
Yes,
on.
Right. Schmieder.org. Find it online. And so generally having a salary helped because I can help feed the money, and we got lots of equipment and ran lots of shows.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you find it a good balance then to be able to have this technology career as well as some other interests like the liberal arts and stuff like that in the theater?
I think you have to have balance. If everything you do is the same as you do for work, then you really don't have a lot of anything else to look forward to. It's just more of the same. Mm-hmm.
And you think maybe, you know, some of the courses you took in the liberal arts actually play a role in you being a better Microsoft engineer?
I'd like to think so. Well, it's other people to be the judge of that, I guess. But you get a broader perspective on things, and you can understand better where people are coming from. You can use language and figure out how to communicate your ideas to other people by having a broader set of experiences to draw upon.
So you often speak Latin in some of your meetings and stuff like that, right?
Poor Latin.
Now, quite often we can have guests on the show here and we're talking about their technology background. Quite often it's very much focused on just technologies, where you've actually taken expanded beyond that quite a bit. I feel that having that level of diversity provides other ways of thinking about problems when you're actually doing things. Do you have any maybe specific problems that have come up recently that you can think of that having a non-technical lean on things maybe helped you solve better?
I don't have any problems recently. I think many of the things that we work on involve communicating with other people and expressing ideas and concepts, particularly technical, complicated ideas and concepts to people who may not be well-versed in the background of either technology in general or in specific areas of, say, Microsoft technology. I was involved with some other people, some of whom were even in this audience, in protocol documentation, for example, where we really needed to express some very complicated concepts that have been built up over 15, 20 years at Microsoft, and you have 3 months and 50 pages to do it in. Getting those concepts out, coming up with phrasing, figuring out what people need to hear, mm-hmm. helps out with that.
So it takes some creative writing almost. You're almost writing a story.
You have to be creative. It's not creative writing. It's nonfiction. Yeah. It's all truth.
There's true stories and there's fake stories. I've seen some documents that look like they're probably fake stories and that sort of stuff.
Well, that's more in product planning.
Yeah. Now, and you focus mostly not on product planning, but actually doing the actual engineering and research directly for the system itself.
We try. We obviously have to be closely tied to the product planning process to make sure give our input into what's tenable, what can be done, what the code that we have, the source code that we have available can support, or how much work it would be to make huge changes or small changes. Yeah, we have to stay close to what actually gets turned into a real product, and it's a large process, a lot of people involved, and we help out.
Now, in getting to Microsoft, did you have any other jobs between college and Microsoft?
No, actually. I came out here. I had intended to stay in the Boston area, but in 1989, Boston technology loop kind of crashed. And I was looking around, and I came out here almost on a lark. And I figured, 2-3 years tops.
And so. And do you remember what your thoughts were about Microsoft back in those days?
It was this kind of...
Because we're still a really small company.
It's a small company that was just doing some stuff for IBM, really. And I didn't really know. That's why I didn't think it was really going to last that long, because... Yeah, it was really IBM that was pulling the strings, right? Mm-hmm. And that didn't last that long.
So in 1989, you finally come to Microsoft. What was your first job?
I was hired into what was then called the Network Business Unit. officially working on a product called Landman 90. But that, it was an attempt at a distributed operating system with, structured integrated storage and, I'm sure you've heard lots of stories about integrated storage here. I won't go into that. As with most things, I got pulled over to the actual product line, which was Land Manager. Landman 2.0 is what I kind of got pulled onto and helped out with that for a while. And then went over, worked on NT briefly during its starting phases, and then back over to a startup project that was called Cairo.
Oh, Cairo, yeah. I remember that well.
Usually people shudder a little bit and look at you funny. And,
Cairo really was a very groundbreaking project that we were working on. And a lot of the stuff that you guys were working on in that project then are actually still coming into the operating system these days.
Cairo as a complete operating system was overly ambitious. Cairo as a set of technologies that really help solve problems and have been able to come out over the last 15 years, and they still come out and appear in different products. I was on the distributed distributed system side, the networking side, not the user interface side. People always have opinions about user interface. But on the networking side, we've been able to leverage a lot of the stuff that the ideas that we originally had in Cairo and take them to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you see as being some of the core tenets that Cairo was trying to achieve as an operating system?
The core tenets that Cairo was trying to achieve. I think the biggest change that we're trying in Cairo was to make the network more central to the way business was done. So while you were still using your PC, obviously, and you're using your applications on the PC, it was a rich experience running Windows, you really wanted to be thinking heavily about distributed computation in the sense of got servers, file servers, print servers, directories of useful objects, and really take strides in moving out towards a less one client and couple servers to lots of clients and gazillions of servers.
Mm-hmm. And you got to remember, this is back in the days when the network really wasn't quite as pervasive as it is now. In our offices, we had usually two computers, one computer working on and one computer that was connected via Xenix to the email system.
Yes, we did have. I did have that in my office when I started.
Yeah.
actually, I still have my Ungerman Bass MPT thick Ethernet transceiver box as a monitor stand. Every time we move, the movers try and hook it up, but they have no idea how it fits together because it doesn't fit with the twisted pair. They don't know what to do. Yeah. So, networking was kind of in its infancy back then, and even back then we still had there's NetBUI, and there was IPX and SPX, and the TCP/IP was, that was kind of a researchy kind of thing. The overhead was viewed as too high, and opposed to NetBUI and some other things. But now, the world runs on IP.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everything is connected.
Everybody's connected.
And it's only getting more.
Water glasses are almost connected. So it's then after working on Cairo, then what else did you do after that?
So after Cairo, we got folded into the Windows NT group, and so we got folded in just in time for NT 3.5 officially, and I stayed in that product line since.
Mm-hmm. And you enjoy actually working on the internals of the system rather than the GUI interfaces?
I do. I find more reward in creating services and systems that just run in the background and you never really think about them, and hopefully they stay up for weeks and months and years. I appreciate a good GUI. I don't have problems giving feedback to the people who are doing it, but that's not actually drawing the pixels is not something that's really been appealing to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, in our previous episode with Rebecca, she mentioned that you guys worked on security together. And security became kind of a big part of your career from that standpoint.
From the beginning, I was hired to do security for Landman 90 in Cairo, and all the way through, I did security for the first 14 years I was here. officially security in the group, and now that's one of the things we worry about. There's a shift between creating security technologies at the time where we were trying to figure out how to do more advanced methods of authentication and securing new communication methods and trying to get the systems online. And then in the last 6 years or so, we've been saying, we don't need as much more new security technology as it is to, everything else has to catch up and deal with a totally new threat model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in a pre-everything's connected world, security from the outside wasn't that big of a deal. And we didn't even think about people being as malicious as we see people being these days.
I think we saw people as being malicious. However, we leveraged a lot of things in the early days about, your building has to have physical security, right? If someone can come in and kick your server in the side and it falls over, worrying about them installing bad software is not the big problem. As everything's gotten connected, then that guy doesn't need to worry about the physical security of your building. He can rap on your doors and test your locks from halfway around the world. Okay, that's a different world. And now the network changes the whole situation. So instead of, here are some bad neighborhoods, or I can decide what level of security I need or physical security on this door, and maybe another secure door inside to keep the server safe. Now it's, that part doesn't matter as much as the fact that we need to figure out what packets are actually going in and out.
So everything is always marching forward. Now you actually are focused not on the current version of Windows and not even necessarily the next version of Windows. You're actually currently working on the version after that, right?
We'll answer that carefully. Everyone in Windows is focused on Windows to some degree, and I'm not working day-to-day on Windows 7, which is the next version that's coming out as of this taping. But I'm on the team that is. I run the internal builds. I file bugs. I work with people. I do reviews of stuff. We dig into possible problem areas and work out kinks of designs that have gone on for the last year. But on the other side, we're also looking at, here's an incubation that we just had a review this week of an incubation that we started up 8 months ago to explore using some of our technology in new ways. That's something that we probably should think seriously about factoring into Windows 8. What should we, or whatever the next version of Windows is.
Windows plus, yeah. Whatever. Yeah. So I'd like to spend some more time talking kind of exactly what your current group is doing, and some of the, as much as you can talk about it anyway, and what some of the problems that we overall need to face on focusing. But before we get to that, we've got another short little blurb we have from one of your current colleagues, Richard Pletcher, and we'd like to see what he has to say about you.
Okay.
So I've been working with Richard Ward for about 5 years now on core architecture team in COSD, and the thing I've always noticed about him is in a meeting, he tends to sort of be a placator. If there's confrontation, he sort of restates both sides of the argument in a more neutral way and usually pacifies things, even with upper management meetings, the same kind of thing.
So I really did try to find someone that gives some dirt on you, but it's like there is no dirt to ask on you. So he's basically saying that you're kind of the guy that holds these meetings together and keeps the different teams kind of at bay sometimes. Do you feel like you do that?
Some days worse than others, yes. Some meetings worse than others. A lot of my job and the job of the senior technical people here is to get people talking about their ideas and their requirements and get them communicating in a way that's actually productive. And some of that involves getting people into a room and getting each side to vent for 10 minutes and get the worst of the vitriol out of the room. And then he's, let's talk about what you're really saying. And usually the differences aren't that much.
Okay. Now, Richard mentioned COSD. Is that like an acronym for?
COSD, it's the Core Operating Systems Division.
And so what does the core architecture mean exactly?
So the core architecture team is a team that was set up about 5-6 years ago, where we were dedicated full time to be thinking about the architecture of the system as a whole. So rather than what we had been doing before, where we had a kind of a collection of people who were deep in their particular technology areas, like networking or security or graphics or something like that, we took about 5 people to kick it off, whose full-time job was to think about the system and how all the pieces fit together, and how what the hard problems were that we're dealing with in the future. And
so you still have the individual team maybe focused on the networking and stuff like that, but now this is a team that sits above them that is seeing how everything pulls together, or besides them?
Well, we very carefully tried not to say above. Right? Well, we're all working on the same product, and we didn't want to become gatekeepers or design mavens or anything like that. It was, more along the lines of, you're doing this. You're doing this in networking. Have you talked to the people in the terminal services stack? Have you talked to so-and-so over there because they're doing something similar? And so in a certain sense, it was a clearinghouse of ideas that were going on, where at the feature design level, where the program managers were communicating back and forth, it was perhaps at a level that didn't describe all the actual technical interactions. And so someone said, we're doing this, and this other team said, we're doing this other thing. We were in the position to say, wow, have you guys talked to so-and-so? Because they're doing something similar, or they're counting on no one using this interface, now it sounds like you are. You got to go work it out.
So did your team actually do programming then, or are you just simply facilitating other programmers? It's kind of hard to...
Yes, we do some programming still. Let's see, what's a good example? Well, we can't just take over for other teams and you're not doing your job right. We'll step in and help you out. That doesn't
as much as you might like to sometimes.
Well, we'll skip that answer. storming in and saying, we're going to come save the day doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help the teams grow. It doesn't help engender better communication or anything else in the future. So where my team is coding still is in incubation areas primarily. Or prototyping and figuring out some things. So we had one of the people working for me during the early part of Vista was investigating how to figure glitch-free audio-video transports, so that when you're streaming something that's high def with real frame rate requirements, how could we adjust priorities and keep the system running and the packets flowing over the net and all these other things without stopping on the video stream? So because when you're actually watching the video, you don't want to see stutters and gaps and pixelation because the frame couldn't be generated correctly. And so he dug in, did lots of coding, figured out what the design should be, but he was prototyping. So we threw it all away and said, here are the requirements, and here's the technique you should use, and gave it to the team three teams, I guess, at that point, to do the right implementation.
Mm-hmm. I think it sounds like extremely important work that you're doing, because it's basically assisting them in getting a leg up on what the problems are, and helps identify the different areas of the system, especially with something like the video playback is going to actually touch different parts of the system. You've got to interoperate the file system with the network, with the video, with all pieces of it.
Yep.
And now, and also you're talking about security being a big thing there. Being a group that is kind of looking at the uber picture of the operating system, since security does dive so deeply across different pieces, that also gives you capability of pulling all that together and understanding what the landscape is like and what some of the possible risks and threats might be.
Yes, I think that for me personally, my history through the security team, where I was, we worked on the kernel code, we worked on distributed networking code, protocols, management tools, even some GUI stuff, that let me have a fairly broad understanding of the operating system. And moving forward, there's lots of things that need to be secured. There's lots of things that affect the security of the system, even though they may not seem that way on the surface. Mm-hmm. And so, even down to the level of, we want your feature to be showcased, but your feature, someone needs to opt into that before you have to do things in a safe way, even though that's whatever you're working on is really important, really cool. you can't surprise people and turn on to, without a warning.
Plus, it also seems that since, you know, you're not necessarily working on a particular technology, but you've got kind of your fingers on all the different technologies across the operating system, this is really where diversity comes in again. I mean, you've got to take, you and your team have to understand the diverse set of technologies involved in an operating system as a big unit.
Yes, we are called upon to understand a lot of things, and unfortunately often on short notice, where, oh, you know, something's maybe not working out right, okay, let's dive in, and you have a couple of weeks to sort some stuff out.
Do you think the other members on your team perhaps also had the same diversity education that you've had with the liberal arts and theater and stuff like that?
I think that we have a fair amount of diversity of backgrounds. I know people who have never had formal higher education on my team, and I've got people who've gone to grad school and everything in between. So, in that sense, yes, I guess we do have lots of diversity.
And do you, I mean, by looking at other teams too, because, like, you know, the whole work-life balancing can also be a problem. Do you think your team, since they're having to think in such a diverse model, perhaps has a better work-life balance than some other teams that are maybe really deeply focused on things? Just kind of...
I would say that the work-life balance is more of a personal choice and how you manage your time rather than the workload that's presented to you. When things are popping, I stay up all night if I have to get some things done, and when things are relaxed, then I can get home at 5 and go play catch with my son. And so it's how you manage your own balance.
Speaking about the home life, you know, I understand you've got a farm. Is that right?
We have a horse farm, yes. My wife runs a boarding facility and dressage facility. So,
I mean, that sounds a bit different from, you know, Microsoft on one hand and farm on the other.
It's a
Green Acres
farm.
Comes to mind a bit. So.
It's a well-wired farm. I think many people from my past are surprised to hear that I'm a gentleman farmer sometimes. So it's great for laughs sometimes too, because I will throw some pictures of me picking a stall or something like that. So I can use that as an analogy for some of my job aspects.
So shoveling manure sometimes is really shoveling manure.
Sometimes it's a metaphor and sometimes it ain't.
Now today in coming into the show, you actually bicycled in to the studios. And so I take it that bicycling is a big part of your life as well.
I do enjoy bicycling, road bikes. Try and do a couple organized rides during the summer. And September has been really nice weather-wise, which is where we are right now. And I got special dispensation not to take my son into work so I could keep biking for a while. my son into school on my way to work.
And how far is the ride from here to home?
It's just under 12 miles. 11.8.
Yep, not too bad.
So it's good hills in the way, and it's a good way to keep things relaxed. Because, you know, the exercise lets you kind of detox after the day on the way home, and kind of gets things, gets your body moving in the morning when you're on your way to work.
Now, do any bicycle racing as well, or just rides?
I'm not the racer in our group. We do have person in our extended virtual team who is a racer, but I just ride.
Right. And what are the sort of things you do just for the fun of it? Like you mentioned, theater is still kind of a partial.
I spent quite a while helping out with the theater theater downtown, and a lot of the kind of the standard hobbies. I like taking pictures and biking and cooking, but we don't get to cook that much right now, so.
And I understand you're into music as well?
Do some music production.
And what does that entail?
Much like the technical theater aspect, it's behind the scenes, doing the recording, the mixing, mix downs, the working at the effects, working with the band itself to figure out what sound they really wanted and record, you know, is this right, it's not right, moving on out.
So you're kind of in the booth.
I'm in the booth.
Yeah. Doing that sort
behind
of
the scenes.
And so do you have, like, you know, you go out to bands and actually record their stuff? Do you bring the bands into your home, or
we've got a studio over our garage, and we basically there's one band, although we've had some other people come in occasionally who need to record small things here and there, but it's one old Microsoft band that comes by.
And do you have any recordings you've actually done that you can available on CD or through downloads?
Well, you know,
there's another option for plugging some of your work, I suppose.
Yes.
So, yeah. Is there a URL something you can go to?
The problem with hobbies is since there's no real incentive, you know, there's no compulsion to actually finish it. So many of the songs are in this. Yeah, okay, it's great, except for, well, you know, they want to redo the one vocal track, or the, you know, the part of the percussion isn't quite right, and so it's perpetually in the mix.
Now, you also mentioned that you would like to be able to be doing more cooking than you're currently doing. What is some of the cooking you like doing when you get a chance?
When I get a chance? I enjoyed cooking Thai cuisine, and baking. Pastries, desserts, you know, cakes. That was always good, but you know, there's a side effect if you bake too many cakes, and something your perimeter tends to grow.
So. That's where the bicycling is supposed to take care of.
Yes. Yeah. But then everyone in the household needs to do that as well. So
if you were not working at Microsoft, what do you think you'd be doing instead? And let's say not in technology per se, or computer technology.
I don't know. I think I would probably stay connected to technology somehow. I don't know.
I mean, these days I think it's probably hard for anybody not to be connected to technology somehow.
I could say pure organic farming with nothing but wooden hose and rainwater. But I think there's technology will always be in something that we do. And so I could say, maybe go back and work with a French theater again, only full time, and go on as managing director or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's still lots of things you have to worry about there. If you don't have a website, you're dead. If you don't have online booking, people start. You can lose a good third of your audience because they can't make a reservation.
Right.
If you're trying to make the leap out of we're just going to take over walks-in off of Pike Street to we want to have fill a 75 person. Room, you need to have a little more control over what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how broad technology has come, and I think networking, like you first got started, it's a big piece of that. I mean, it allows people to actually see
the
value.
It's all about the network.
It's all about the network. But now it's all about the core architecture, right?
Well, networking fits into a bigger picture.
So, Richard, in each episode, we like to have a certain set of questions we always ask people so we can kind of, set the level playing field and stuff. And then we'll take and open up to the audience, and so they can ask questions about core architecture, security, or shoveling manure. Who knows what they're going to be interested in, but we'll find out in a couple of minutes.
Probably not manure.
So, what advice do you have for people in your field?
For people in my field, software in general or in architecture?
I would say you're doing something like core architecture.
Well, the architecture aspect is really understanding the components that you are involved in, and more importantly, understanding how they relate to other components and what the interactions are and dependencies and side effects and all the other lines that you can draw between components when you line them up in some big whiteboard diagram. For people who are coming into this area, we've been working with a number of people who are on kind of the senior individual contributor track or architect, and we're focusing on you have to know your area, know how to design in your area, deliver in your area, and then the next step that we're adding is how to get them connected to a broader community so they can share not just information with other people, but build up the community of like-minded individuals. So, get connected, I guess would be the summary of all that.
Keep a broader look at the whole playing field. How would you describe your work to someone who's not technical? Which it seems like all of us have to do on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Seems like.
Well, yeah, right after you get through the three questions about how do I fix this thing on my computer, and your relatives say, oh, what is it that you do? I usually focus on the design and integration aspect. That, you know, the group that I run is all about figuring out how different parts of Windows work best together and how to move forward on some of the problems that people are facing right now. Mm-hmm. And I say, anything else? We'll get technical. Do you want to go deeper? Oh, no, that's enough.
In life, what will you compare to producing software?
Well, there's some unfavorable comparisons, but we can skip those. I think it's the creative impulse. No matter what area of the software product that you're involved in, that you're working on, you're taking something, an idea that you've synthesized, and you are expressing it in a tangible form, and you get to see the results. And so it's like any other creative thing, whether it's cooking and you're adding stuff to the skillet, or if you're painting, or you're writing a book, or you figured out the spreadsheet, and now you're all you get the numbers for your company balance. It's the success of your creative impulse and seeing the results.
And again, that sounds like a kind of a diverse mindset in paying attention to what all is going on.
It's all about creating something that is of value, at least to you, and hopefully to others.
And let's finish this sentence. You know you're a computer nerd when?
You know you're a computer nerd when someone forwards you a picture and a joke about the Large Hadron Collider and you get it.
I haven't seen that joke yet. What was it? 43 afterwards. Now, do you see people having a hard time understanding, what a computer geek is and what a non-computer geek is?
I'm not sure what the differentiation is.
People that would get that joke. I mean, do you feel that kind of puts you in a different sort of social structure, and people from the outside don't quite understand it quite as well?
I think, in the case of that joke in particular, it wasn't specifically about computer science or software or anything like that. It was there's some video games, and then there's this whole thing about big science and this collider that's going to, some naysayers are saying going to create strangelets and black holes and stuff that they don't understand, but it sounds good. And so, being in the know and being able to apply rational thought is the common theme. It's like, oh, wait, that doesn't make sense, and that's why it's a joke. Mm-hmm. That's why we're making light of it.
Okay. Now here comes the part that everyone loves. And that is where you get to actually exercise your creative talent, mm-hmm, by drawing a picture of your favorite data diagram.
Okay.
You got something in mind?
I do.
Okay. So go ahead and draw the picture and then sign it, and then we'll explain it to the audience. Mm-hmm. We've only got one color of pen, so you can't do anything too Picasso-esque.
Can't quite get the blue line in there, but it's okay.
Go ahead and sign it.
All right. Guessing you don't sign things with a Sharpie that often.
So, what is this?
This is the data flow between a client, a server, and a domain controller for Windows 2000 domains and later for purposes of authentication. It's a diagram I've drawn for no small number of engineers, executives, litigators,
can you explain what's going on?
The client first requests an authentication credential, a ticket from the domain controller, and it comes back, and then the client can then apply that to the server, and the server can respond favorably or not. But we've eliminated this back channel between the server and the domain controller, which improved a lot of performance characteristics. Mm-hmm.
And are there security aspects associated with this as well?
Oh, it's all about implementing a friendly security protocol.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
I'm sure we'll find a nice place to hang this in the hallway. And now, the fun part, we get to open up to the audience to see if they have any questions for you. Does anybody have any questions about farming, bicycling, computers?
So, Rich, you've worked on a lot of things, and I've known you for a lot of years. What do you want to do 10 years from now? What do you think you're headed towards? What's your next technology?
What's coming down in 10 years? I think what we're most focused on is understanding how our assets like Windows will play in a world where everything is constantly connected and highly portable. And we have an incredible base to work from, but our base also comes from dealing with from heredity of desktops and enterprise servers and things like that. And so a shift to constantly connected but varying latency and stuff bouncing around strangely and got some data here and some data there, and it's part of it's in your pocket, part of it's at your laptop, and that we're going to have a very disaggregated future, and we have to figure out how it all works.
Now, if you compare where computers are today with this constantly connected attitude they have from 10 years ago when they weren't quite so constantly connected, do you think in 10 years from now we'll see as big or bigger of an alteration of what computers are actually doing and how they're integrating themselves in our lives?
Yeah, I think that the past 10, 15, 20 years we've had connectivity is mostly driven by either you're in the consumer space or you're in your workspace, and the twain really never met. And then there's this kind of mini shift where people start dialing in from their home machine, and then there's a backlash because those machines were usually not clean. And in the future, we're going to have these problems where you're not just constantly connected to one network, you're constantly connected to a variety of different networks and hierarchies and authorities. And so I may be, my cell phone, for example, is always connected to AT&T or whatever carrier you have to be using. My cell phone's always connected to its carrier, and it's always chattering back and forth, regardless whether I'm in a secure building or if I'm at home. And that's only going to extend as we get smarter devices in our pockets and in our laptops. Laptops already have cell phone chips in them. So whose rules apply? If you think, the notion of the firewall is going away. So things are going to shift around, I think, kind of dramatically in that sense.
So the network's no longer necessarily being controlled by your work or whatever. It's just a broad network.
Yeah. Well, one network is and one network isn't, and you're bridging them. So how do we create that bridge correctly?
Yeah, very good. Is there a question from the audience?
Richard, I'm curious. Which of the projects that you've worked on over the years had the largest sense of mission that you felt, and why was that?
The largest sense of mission, it kind of varied. The sense of mission works best the smaller the team, because the vision is shared. And so, for example, the Cairo project, while ultimately unsuccessful, was pretty well understood, and everyone kind of signed into the central vision. I think Windows 2000 had a great sense of mission for a comparatively large team. There were just under 1,000 people, I think, working on it at the time. And people knew what it was. Plug and play and distributed systems, and everything else was okay. If it fits into one of those, you're on. When we did XPSP2, I think the notion was shared. The core of the team was small, and so we really had a good understanding. But we were able to get the rest of the organization signed up because the outside pressures were so evident of why something like that had to come together.
Okay, thank you.
So then, you're talking about a smaller team has a better sense of mission associated to them. Do you think that means that a smaller team is better than a larger team?
A smaller team is better than a larger team depending on the size of the project. There's only so much a small handful of people can do. You can't expect them to change the world. But when teams are small, then communication is, the bandwidth is very, very high, and everyone shares a lot of knowledge. Everyone shares what's trying to be done, and from an engineering perspective, everyone gets to see everyone else's check-ins, right? So you really know what's going on, and you can really say, whoa, what did you do? Or, oh, that was really cool. Now I can leverage that. The larger the team, the harder it is to maintain that level of communication.
Now, with a project like Windows, which obviously is going to be a big team, how do you handle something like that efficiently?
I think that's one of our ongoing challenges. Yes, it is a big team. There are 3,000 people in the COSI division. There are another 1,200 people in the WEX division. There's roughly a comparable number of people in the server division, all working on this thing. That's a lot of people to try and get shared. So there's structured communication that you do, where you try and get thought leaders in a room and make sure everyone shares at least some set of common principles or goals, and then try and get lots of other communities set up that let people share information, mm-hmm. like, for example, an architect community.
So a social networking inside the company, kind of.
I think it's very important.
Okay. Thank you. Now, let's take another question.
Yeah. Richard, as you know, one of the important things as an architect is to how to be influential without really having authority. And I was curious about your sense on how to be successful in that regard as an architect.
In a certain sense, the hallmarks of our profession is that we have very little organizational authority, and it's all based on influence. Part of this is to establish a good working relationship with the organizational authority, right? So that when you come and you say, hey, I think we need to look at X, that it's not just someone blowing a lot of smoke and things. So if you say, that's a weird thing that the networking guys are doing. Let me go talk to the head of the networking group. That works. And it comes back to what we were talking about earlier with the social network, right? So you build your set of people who are in either similar positions, like the architect for the network group or the architect for the security group or so on, where you can say, hey, something's going on, I don't understand this, can you tell me what's going on? Or, hey, we're about to do something in this regard, it's going to affect you. If you always go with demands, then you're going to be unfortunately tagged as someone who comes with a bunch of demands. If you come with offering help or offering warnings or, hey, we see these changes coming down the road, then you become a resource that other people want to listen to and respect their opinions. So the advice, I guess, would be, number one, build your social network of similar senior technical talent. And second is, just because you're not in organizational authority doesn't mean that you can't that you're freed from the responsibility of knowing how organizational authority works.
We've got a question over here.
Yes, you said that you wanted to become an architect after leading a team do more, put your individual contributing to a test. I guess my question is do you feel that actually leading a team, a dev team, actually helped you become a better architect than you would have been without having gone that management track for a period of time?
That's a good question. I think that running a development team helps a lot to understand how the whole engineering process works, right? And to understand that when I've got a design in mind, how many man weeks or person months and developer years or whatever it's going to take to get done, gives you an understanding of what a regression rate really means, lets you understand a lot of things. It's a tool. It's a way to learn how the whole system works. I don't think it's required of everybody. I can think of, in fact, several people who I think are going to make great architects who really should not ever run a team. And I can think of a number of good managers who really shouldn't be architects at all. And so it's a tool, and I encourage some people to try it on their path up the ranks, and some people, like I said, no, not so much.
Do you ever think you might want to be a manager again?
Well, technically I am a manager now. I've got 6 reports, and that's about the right number.
So it's a smaller team.
Small team. They're all senior people. It's not, in a certain sense, friends of mine who actually manage large teams, I think, view me as cheating slightly, since I don't have a lot of problem employees or anything like that. They're all senior, high productive, you know, folks. I'm not one who's looking for running a huge development organization. It's just not something I want to do.
Now, do you still get to write code yourself?
I do actually sneak time to write code. It's not always checked into the shipping product, but I put together some scaffolding code for some of the prototype efforts that we're doing, and keep my hand in. I have to retain some credibility.
I see we have a question over here.
So we had the opportunity to learn about your educational background and your life, and I was curious to hear perhaps about who your greatest mentors have been throughout your professional career and your life, and what important lessons you learned from them.
Mentors. Well, there are a lot of people who I've learned from over the years and in differing capacities. I learned a lot from the old DEC crowd that came in to do NT. I learned from Dave Cutler. I learned a lot from reading his code. And I also had my office was three doors down from Dave's for several years, and I learned a number of things. let's see, Mark Lukowski, another old NT engineer, was a huge system guy. I learned a lot from hanging out in his office and asking him about how things worked and design issues and sorting through things. My previous boss, Rob Short, I learned a lot of how to finesse difficult situations and get people talking and listening skills and things like that. There are a lot of people I've learned from over the years. So it's, and some of them are even here still, I guess. And you also learn from your peers, right? It's not, I don't want to make it sound like, oh, you have to go find a senior person and latch on. I think you learn a lot from working with people and in the sense of what works and what doesn't work when you're talking to other people, and just areas that they know and skill sets that they bring to the table.
Thanks. You know, do you think these people know that you learned something from them?
I think so.
Stay in touch with them. And the flip side of that, do you think there's people who look to you as their mentor?
I have several people who have, you know, under the mentor program that I meet with regularly, and you know, I try to help out people who are in architect track jobs whenever I can. I guess I should probably go back and figure out if it's working.
Thank you, Richard, from the Technical Community Network, for being our guest today. And thanks to all in the audience for coming.